Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about some of the challenges faced right now at the moment by the U.S. auto industry. And certainly it is true that there was a time when the U.S. dominated auto manufacturing around the world, but certainly that is not the case now. In January, for example, Ford announced a big loss, $14.6 billion loss for 2008. They said that last year, had been the worst in its company's history. Chrysler filed for bankruptcy at the end of April. And now, with the news that we have this morning, it seems to be pretty clear that General Motors is also expected to file for bankruptcy. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about what lies ahead for the formerly Big Three. And our guest for the program is Dennis Virag. He is president at the Automotive Consulting Group. This is something that he co-founded back in 1986 and has served as its managing director since that time. Since 1967, he's been doing managing and consulting with organizations in the automotive industry, and so has been doing a lot of thinking about the auto industry, following it, writing about it, talking about it, and we're pleased to have us here on the show, have him here with us on the show today. He's the founder of Autotech Strategies Incorporated. That's an industry-focused management consulting firm that has served both domestic and international clients in the auto industry going back to 1979. He worked at Ward's Automotive Research. That's an automotive forecasting and market research company. He's a member of the Society of Automotive Engineers and also served as Midwest Regional Vice President of the Society of Automotive Analysts. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. And the only thing that we ask people who are calling in is that they try to keep their comments, questions brief, just so we can keep moving along. But of course, anyone listening is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we also do have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, your questions are welcome. Mr. Virag, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks. And yourself?
Very good, thank you.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. Certainly, we have a big news day here in the making for the U.S. automakers. Big stories here developing with GM, and also we'll be talking about Chrysler, I'm sure. Why don't we talk about General Motors? It looks as if now it seems almost certain, and I think that it was widely expected, but it seems now almost certain that GM will be filing for bankruptcy. You think that's right?
I think that's highly probable. I think the odds of GM filing for bankruptcy are about 99%.
Well, now, tell us a little bit about how we got to this point now, and some of the negotiations that were going on, and how it is particularly this involved an appeal to people who are holding bonds, who are GM bondholders, and how it involved them, and perhaps also how it involved the people who build the cars, the auto workers.
Well, the way it evolved, you need to begin 25, 30 years ago when the Japanese auto manufacturers began to sell vehicles in volume in the U.S. And the domestic manufacturers for decades did not see the Japanese as a competitive threat. The UAW did not see the Japanese as a competitive threat, and what we had was a period of time where both the UAW and management had their heads in the sand, and we had bad union agreements. We had companies quick to make agreements, and that evolved into a situation where foreign companies set up manufacturing facilities in the U.S., they began capturing even more market share. Europeans came to the U.S., set up manufacturing facilities. Koreans came here. And over the over a three-decade period, the domestic manufacturers lost about 50% of their volume. Mm. And, it was a situation where they had excess capacity. They had high labor rates. They had high legacy costs, and they were just non-competitive.
You know, one of the things, as I was going along and looking at articles and thinking about our conversation today, I was going along through the internet and came across one particular place, and there was an article that made it sound like, well, it's what's going on today. It was talking about the troubles of the American automakers, and I looked at that, and then I realized what it was I was looking at was an article about a book that had been written 6 years ago by Michelin Maynard, who for a long time was the auto correspondent at the New York Times, talking about the difficulties that the automakers were facing and making this prediction that I think is something like in the next 10 years, and this she was writing this in 2003, that within the next decade, one of the big three would no longer exist in its present form. And I'm thinking, boy, you know, if she was saying that 6 years ago, How is it that the automakers were ignoring what clearly were trends that at least she and I'm sure other people saw so long ago? And at least at that point, you would think they would have tried to start doing things differently.
Well, I could even take you back farther to a period, I believe it was the early 1980s, when an individual wrote the book On a Clear Day I Could See General Motors. That outlined the problems within General Motors, systemic problems, the lack of focus, the ineptness of General Motors as a corporation, and predicting the demise of General Motors, and that was in the early 1980s. So, you know, you could go back in time. Another instance I believe it was about 2005, I wrote an article called The Automotive Industry, an Industry in Crisis. And what I pointed out was that over time, we have a recession in the auto industry once every decade. And the decline in sales ranges from anywhere from 25% to 33%. And the last recession we had was in 1991. So I was saying any day now we could expect a major recession and sales volumes would likely drop in the area of 30%. Guess what? Everyone got upset with me because they said, well, we have overcome the cycle. We've learned how to manage the economy and we're not going to have any such economic situation. People just don't want to hear the bad news or a prediction of bad news when times are good.
Yeah. Well, let me also ask you to react to something. A couple of weeks ago, I talked to Bill Holstein, and I don't know if you know him. He's somebody who's also been for a long time been watching the auto industry. He's a journalist and has written a book about GM and spent quite a few years in and around GM talking to the people who are running the company and so forth. And he said that he felt that GM was actually right on the brink of turning a corner and turning things around, that they had changed the way that they do things, that they had a very promising vehicle in the Chevy Volt, and that they just got caught up in the spike in oil prices and then the credit crunch, which made it impossible to get credit or very difficult to get credit, and that in fact, as far as GM was concerned, that you know maybe it was just a matter of bad luck that these things came together at this time, and that if that had not happened, we wouldn't be talking about a GM bankruptcy today. What do you think about that?
Well, I think there's some truth to that, but you know, when you look at the situation, you know, GM had excess capacity. They had excess dealer counts. They had high costs in terms of both labor and legacy costs. You know, in order to maintain sales, they had to resort to incentives, which further reduced the profitability of vehicles. So, again, some people were seeing, positive signs. But again, if you looked at all the data points that were available, you know, it was certainly clear that General Motors would have to downsize, they would need to restructure, and that if there was an economic downturn, which most people were not predicting, that General Motors would be in very serious financial straits.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just reintroduce very quickly our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Dennis Viereg. He's president at the Automotive Consulting Group that's located in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He's one of the co-founders of the group. It's been around since 1986, and he is someone that in a number of capacities over the years has followed the U.S. auto industry, worked as a consultant for a number of companies, and is talking with us here this morning about what lies ahead for the big three here in the United States. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, now that it seems that the bankruptcy for GM seems essentially a certainty, I think everybody thinks that it's going to happen. Well, what exactly do you think that's going to mean for the company?
Well, I think the company is going to, number one, I think they will survive, you know, given the, you know, assurance and backing of the U.S. government. But they will be a much smaller company, and in competitive terms, I think they will be more competitive coming out of the bankruptcy than they are today. Again, they will be more focused on the on the product area, on customers, and going through this what we refer to as a near death experience. Mm-hmm. We find that companies are much better after the experience than before.
Well, one of the things that we know, a number of things that we know, I guess, that the company is doing, it's scaling down. There will be fewer dealerships. There will be no more Pontiacs. It's trying to get rid of Hummer. It's trying to sell its overseas division. It's trying to sell Opel. So clearly this company is going to be a smaller, more slimmed down company in the future than it is now. What do you think that it's going to look like? Assuming that you're correct and GM does survive, it comes out of this perhaps a more competitive, a smaller company. What do you think it's going to look like?
I think it's going to look more like Ford. several years ago, that would have been ironic to say that. But, I think that it will be, as I said, smaller. They will not be global in nature. They will have overseas operations, but the where Ford primarily focuses on North America and Europe and has some operations in South America, GM really will be focusing more on North America and Asia, primarily China, with some operations in South America. Mm-hmm. So, the companies will be perhaps I could describe it as a mirror image of each other. Both smaller than they were, a decade ago, much more focused on the, on the product, on the needs of the market, and much more streamlined and profitable.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is calling us from Lovington. This is our line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Hello.
Yeah.
I guess I got a question that's more general and overarching, and obviously I'm with you all on this, but I just always kind of wonder why we all care so much about the automotive industry. I'd listen for that and have another comment if you got time.
Okay. Well, the question is, and I suppose that's a question a lot of people are asking, is it important that these companies survive?
I believe that it's important for the manufacturing sector of the economy to survive. For decades we've been saying that, well, we don't need manufacturing. We could be a service-oriented society. Well, if you look at all developed countries and developing countries outside of the U.S., they all covet the manufacturing sector. As developing countries, India, China, their primary focus is on the automotive industry because it has such a vital area within the economy, plus the tentacles are so great that they touch all sectors of the economy. Manufacturing, in the past has had high-paying jobs. It's been the what I would call the foundation of the economy. When you see a country lose its manufacturing base, like Great Britain, you know, it loses its place in leadership in the world economy. So, you know, and the other aspect is in terms of national defense. You know, if you go back in, you know, in World War II, you know, when we needed the manufacturing infrastructure to convert to manufacturing military tools and equipment, you know, we had that infrastructure in place. Without that infrastructure, you know, we have a potential risk to the future viability of to the U.S. So it's a again, in my estimation, and the estimation of you know, a number of people, you know, it is a vital and core component of a vibrant economy.
Yeah, I think that's a real good way you just put it. And but you know, it's kind of frustrating, you know, sitting here and looking at that and how important it is to everyone in our economy. And you look at some of the things the manufacturers have done, and it kind of almost feels like the rest of us are sitting here shaking our hands while they just basically just kind of skim the money out of it and go along and build a bigger SUV for next year, despite, you know, everybody thinking that maybe the Volt might be the way to go for the future. They're so short term, and let's get the money out of my business now, and the rest of us are going, but we really need you to be around 15 years from now. Come on, can we do something about that? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the manufacturers really produce the vehicles that consumers purchased. Now, there is a segment of society that will purchase an electric vehicle or a hybrid electric vehicle. You know, the Prius is a prime example. But when gas prices are low, sales of the Prius have dropped precipitously. When gas prices were high, they went up. And as long as fuel prices are low in the U.S., you're going to see consumers trending towards larger, less fuel-efficient vehicles. In fact, I cite the example of Toyota because everyone sees Toyota as being the world-class company, as being the company to emulate. However, Toyota was actually emulating the product programs of General Motors, and most people don't understand that. Toyota was moving into large pickup trucks. They were moving into large SUVs. You know, they just built a new pickup truck plant down in San Antonio, Texas. They had a new large SUV plant on the drawing board in Mississippi. And Toyota, on a global basis, is losing as much money today as General Motors. They've overexpanded. They've over-capitalized. In fact, Toyota is being supported by the Japanese government, and little is being reported about that.
Well, I think this raises what I'm sure is a very difficult and frustrating issue for the American automakers. That is, at one point they were doing very well selling big, heavy, fuel inefficient vehicles, SUVs and trucks. Then we have this big spike in oil prices, and suddenly people decide they're concerned with fuel economy, and we're all over the U.S. automakers because they don't have small fuel-efficient vehicles. And then when the price of gas turns around a little bit, goes down a little bit, that suddenly people start looking back at the stuff that they were driving before, and it seems like I'm not exactly sure how it is that a large company is expected to respond to demand when it shifts that quickly, unless they can somehow manage to continue to produce something for everyone and be able to satisfy both of these kinds of markets. Because it seems pretty clear, as you say, when gas is cheap or when people think it's cheap enough, then they're going to drive SUVs and they're going to drive trucks, and they'll only start thinking about it once gasoline starts to get to a certain price.
Yes, and the problem in the U.S., is we try to control the market via mandates on the manufacturers, and the consumer is put in a position where they could do anything they want. We are We're going about it in a wrong manner. What we need to do is we need to have a pull strategy where you pull these vehicles into the market by creating a demand for them rather than a push strategy trying to push fuel-efficient vehicles on consumers. So if you talk to the automotive executives, they say higher gas prices are what's needed to pull the consumers into the more fuel-efficient vehicles. Now, nobody likes taxes, especially on fuel, but if we're going to correct this situation, we need to get the American public off the addiction on cheap oil. And when you track the demand for oil on a global basis and you look at the usage in the U.S., 70% of fuel usage in the U.S. is for transportation, 70%. Mm-hmm. And we are much more hungry for fuel in the U.S. than anywhere else in the world. You know, it's a serious problem. We need to correct it, but yet the politicians do not have the political courage to go about doing what's right and providing market incentives, developing that pull strategy for the sale of small fuel-efficient vehicles rather than putting the onus on the manufacturers. Really, the onus is on the consumer, not the manufacturer. Mm. But yet, the politicians feel they're not going to be elected if they take that approach.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Dennis Virag. He's president at the Automotive Consulting Group in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He co-founded the group in 1986 and has served as its managing director since that time. Since 1967, he's been managing and consulting with organizations in the auto industry. He founded Auto Tech Strategies Incorporated, an industry-focused management consulting firm. He also was, recruited by Ward's Automotive Research. That's an auto forecasting and market research company. And he's talking with us this morning about the U.S. automakers and what lies ahead for particularly for these three companies, Chrysler, GM, and Ford. Questions here on the program are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller up here is in Belgium, line four. Hello.
Good morning. First, start off with, I question his facts about 70% of fuel is used in the automobile industry. An awful lot of coal is used for generating electricity. But that's not where I wanted to get into the topic here. What I wanted to suggest and talk about is, over here in this area, we were a General Motors area over here in Danville. They had a large plant here. And through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, early 90s, I guess 90s too, they didn't produce a very good car. And that's why a lot of people ran to other type of automobiles. And now these same people who didn't produce a very nice car are very upset about the fact that their pension funds are being put in a serious jeopardy because of the bankruptcy of these automobile companies. And then on top of that, the people who are going to be responsible for those pension funds are you and me and our tax dollars. So now for their inefficiency and their lack of foresight is putting them not only out of business, but in jeopardizing their pension funds. And once again, the American people are going to have to solve this problem for them. Somehow this doesn't seem quite right.
Well, Mr. Virag, do you have a thought about that?
I certainly do, and the caller is absolutely correct. I go back in time, and again, when we started the discussion, you know, I pointed out the decades of mistakes by both management and labor. If you recall, and I recall this vividly, there was a strike in Peoria, Illinois, at Caterpillar Tractor. Caterpillar took on the union because Caterpillar recognized it was under a global threat by Komatsu, who was a construction equipment company from Japan that was becoming a dominant world player. Caterpillar management recognized that they could not continue to operate in the status quo position, and they took on the UAW. And it was a very, very tough battle. It was a situation where neighbors wouldn't talk to each other. They would get into fist fights. But like a good parent, Caterpillar said to the child, we need to do what's best for you and what's best for the family. After 2 years, there was finally labor agreement between Caterpillar and the union, and Caterpillar today is perhaps the strongest equipment manufacturer in the world. And the reason they are is because they had the discipline, they had the foresight, and they had the wherewithal to recognize where the world economy was going, the competitive threat they were under, and to make difficult choices. Although it hurt at the time, it made them much better for the future. And the big three were never in the situation where they were willing to take on the UAW and to position themselves for success in the future. What the management did at the auto companies, and they just put off the problems to the next CEO and said, well, I'll take my bonus, I'll take my salary, I'll take labor peace, and let the next guy worry about it. It is a very difficult situation we face here in the U.S. We will get through it. We are a very resilient people. However, it's going to be a difficult challenge. It's going to be there's going to be a lot of pain and suffering. But as I referred to before, the manufacturing sector in the U.S. is vital to the economy. If we have the manufacturing sector of the Midwest implode, I believe it could bring down both the East Coast and the West Coast. And both coasts do not want to help the manufacturing sector. You know, they're more service-oriented on the East Coast. The West Coast is more high-tech. They see manufacturing as just a nuisance. However, again, it is the foundation of the economy, and we do need to save it.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Let me just take a moment here, and I've got some other callers I'm going to get to in just a moment. But I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about Chrysler. I mentioned at the beginning of the program, this is going to be a big news day for the auto industry. The first big story was what's going on with GM and the fact that it looks like a near certainty that there's going to be the bankruptcy. There's also going to be a hearing today involving Chrysler, its plan to come out of bankruptcy and to join with Fiat. And they're looking for a judge essentially to say, okay, what do you think is likely to happen there? Do you have some feeling about that?
Well, I think given the situation, I think the judge will allow Chrysler to emerge from bankruptcy under a new Chrysler. But a significant part of Chrysler is still going to be in bankruptcy with various entities fighting for the remaining parts. The thing that I do not understand is that under the new Chrysler, they're saying Fiat is going to buy the new Chrysler. But Fiat is putting $0 into the entity. There's no cash going in. There's no assumption of current or future liabilities. Why are we giving Chrysler to Fiat? That's my question. You know, there's a good reason to save Chrysler, but doing it with Fiat just does not make sense to me. And when you look at Fiat is not a strong auto manufacturer. Their quality ratings in Europe are average. In fact, several years ago, Fiat itself was on the brink of bankruptcy. Now they're looking to, quote, acquire Chrysler U.S. and potentially Opel of Europe. Again, a lot of companies have gotten in the situation they're in today by over-leveraging their situation. And that's what I see Fiat doing. And I see Fiat, or, you know, Chrysler, the new Chrysler, coming back to the U.S. government in a year asking for more funds, because there will be no new product from Chrysler for at least 18 months, probably 2 years. They're saying that, you know, the Fiat small vehicles are going to save Chrysler. Well, you know, they still have to prove that to me. You know, I joke with some people, and I say, I'm from Missouri, you need to show me. I just don't have faith that Fiat's going to be the savior for Chrysler, as some people predict.
Yeah, I think there are actually some people who are saying that not only will it not be the savior, but it'll be the end of Chrysler. That is, the Fiat, what they just want it to get their hands on whatever there that's worth selling, so that what might be likely to happen is that they're simply going to take it apart. If there's something that's worth keeping, keep it. If they can sell the pieces, sell it. And then I think some people think, actually, if this deal goes through, we're actually looking at the end of Chrysler.
It could very potentially be the case. The real value for Chrysler is the Jeep and Jeep brand.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Automotive Task Force, one of their consultants has recommended that Chrysler eliminate the Wrangler brand. And if you study automotive, the Wrangler brand has the highest customer loyalty of any brand in existence. And for an academic to be a consultant to the auto task force and recommend such a thing is just outlandish. In fact, I've spoken to news reporters and I mentioned that, and they said, geez, they said, even we know you can't do that. That's the goose that laid the golden egg for Chrysler. Why kill it? But, we're going ahead with the transformation of Chrysler, the old Chrysler, the new Chrysler. And in some respects, I view that as the shell game. You have a changing of the of the name. You have a restructuring. You have the good Chrysler come out of bankruptcy, and that's the good assets. And the administration and task force is going to proclaim, well, we saved Chrysler, but the vast majority of Chrysler is still in bankruptcy. What about that? So where is the good and where is the bad, and how are we saving Chrysler?
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. We have a couple of cell phone callers. We'll take them in the order they came in, and we'll start with line one right here. Hello. Caller there, Hello. Line one. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to I remember that back in the 80s when the presidential campaign was coming, the Republican candidates, Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr., and I think Bob Dole and a couple others, and then there was John Anderson from Rockford, Illinois. And on a forum, they were asked, "Well, what are your programs?" And everybody was going to expand. And John Anderson said, "Well, I want to put I think it was 50 cent. It was either 25 or 50 cent tax on a gallon of gas, and maybe we can cut down consumption. Number one, and number two, we'll use that money for alternative fuels and for research." And, he got booted off the stage practically, And until the public realizes that we have to cut down on this consumption, nothing's going to happen. And politicians, we blame the politicians all the time, but the politicians want to get elected, and they know if they do something like that, they'll be just laughed off like John Anderson. So I'll leave it go at that. I've got other things, but that's my main point.
All right. Well, I don't know. Anything you want to add to that, Mr. Virek?
Yes. Certainly you cannot campaign on an increased cost for fuel. But once you're elected, I think you really need to do what's good for the country rather than what's good for yourself. And we have a political environment where that's what politicians do. They do what's good for themselves first, and what's good for the country is an afterthought. I've mentioned before that the politicians do not have the political courage to do what's right. We need to educate the consumer, number one. We need to end the dependency on foreign oil, on high consumption. We need to put in place incentives for the purchase of fuel-efficient vehicles. We need to put in place disincentives for purchasing low fuel-efficient vehicles, because it is possible to have a large fuel efficient vehicle. It's just the cost, the cost will be higher, but those incentives need to be in place. The again, mandating the manufacturers produce certain types of vehicles is not going to get the job done. It is a problem with the American public. It's a problem with the American consumer. And until the government takes a stand and says, we need to do this because this is the correct thing to do, we are not going to resolve the problem. Even if a politician goes in and realizes that they're only going to have one term, that is the right thing to do. And politicians need to run for office and be elected to do the right things for America, not to do the right things for themselves.
Okay, let's talk with somebody else. This is also somebody on a cell phone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hi, yes. Okay, it's been an interesting conversation. I want to bring up 2 points and hear your response. One is that I think one of the big assumptions in the industry is that you can't have a large car, which is what Americans want, but a car that's also fuel efficient. The industry seems to have treated that question as if it's an engineering polar opposite and that it's impossible. And I challenge that. I think that that's the problem is everybody assumes if you have a big car, it absolutely cannot be fuel efficient. I just doubt that engineering aspect. Second thing is I bought a little Escort in 1993 and it got 36 miles per gallon. In 2003, I bought a PT Cruiser, and that was rated at 25. So are we saying that technology is somehow getting worse? I happen to see a commercial with Dustin Hoffman from the mid-60s where he was hawking a Volkswagen. It was his first commercial. And he said that in the commercial, the Volkswagen was getting 36 miles per gallon. Again, mid-60s. So is technology getting worse? At this point, what I hear you saying is that it's the consumer's fault and it's the politician's fault. I think the fault lies squarely in the auto industry's failure to engineer cars that are large, like Americans want, and fuel efficient. You sound more like an apologist for the industry than somebody who's studying it objectively, and I'd just like to hear your response to that. Thanks much.
All right. Well, again, Mr. Vareg, what do you think?
Well, you could build a larger vehicle with better fuel efficiency. However, there's a cost associated with that. And again, the consumers want the most for the least. When you look at the sales of SUVs, look at the incentives on those vehicles. Oftentimes you see $6,000, $8,000, $10,000 incentives. That's because they were inexpensive to manufacture, high profit margins, and the consumer was looking for the best bargain. Now, I'll take you back in time in the 1979-1980 time period. I actually worked on a project for a French company to develop a four-passenger vehicle that got 80 miles per gallon. We met that criteria in terms of fuel efficiency and capacity in terms of passengers. The problem was the cost of that vehicle was so high that sales would be very, very limited. And when you have a limited demand for those types of vehicles, prices are always significantly higher than other vehicles. And I'll give you an example of today. You look at the Prius. Again, the Prius is higher cost than a conventional internal combustion vehicle. And people are buying the lower cost conventional fueled vehicles, conventional powertrain vehicles, because they are less expensive. So again, you could do things in terms of fuel efficiency. There are costs associated with it. And the consumer, again, is always looking for the biggest bang for the buck in terms of value, rated in terms of vehicle utility, vehicle cost, and whatever is required to meet their family environment. So again, I go back to the consumer, and a lot of consumers don't like to hear that, but we are, and the industry is focused on meeting and delivering the demands of the consumer. Believe me, if consumers wanted large fuel efficient vehicles and were willing to pay the price, the manufacturers would be producing those vehicles.
We have about 10 minutes left. I have a couple of callers here I want to get to. Let me reintroduce our guest. Dennis Viereg is president at the Automotive Consulting Group in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and since the late 60s has been managing and consulting with organizations in the auto industry. He's a member of the Society of Automotive Engineers, has served as Midwest Region Vice President of the Society of Automotive Analysts, worked at Ward's Automotive Research, that's an automotive forecasting and market research company, where he served as Vice President General Manager. And then in 1986, he co-founded the Automotive Consulting Group and continues to do a lot of writing and speaking about the auto industry. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go to line number three, and someone in Champaign, I believe. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm calling in a comment to the caller from Danville, and then the speaker seemed to agree with him. And the caller from Danville asserted that the Tillman plant made bad cars, and therefore the pensions shouldn't be honored for the people that had worked at that plant. And my first point is that the cars are designed way up the ladder, and what cars are going to be produced, that's decided way up the ladder. The union workers did their jobs, had a contract. It should be honored. The United States government has now got a stake in GM by their choice, so they have to honor these pensions. And too often, way too often, the blame for industry failure is put on the backs of the unions. And I think the people in the country make the mistake of thinking that the unions and the union members are greedy people. They do want a bigger chunk of the profits, and they're not capitalists, and so there has to be a determination by the capitalists as to how much they should contract for. And when a contract is made with the unions, it should be honored. And those people did not make bad cars because of sloth or inefficiency in Tillman.
Well, okay, Mr. Viereg, you want to respond to that at all?
Well, my response would be that most UAW workers were very diligent about doing their job, but in society, we always have that segment, maybe 10 to 15% of society, that is rebellious, that does not want to do the right thing, that thinks they are entitled to various things. And with a union, those people are protected. And I myself have been in the union. My parents, my father was a union member all his life. All my relatives have been union members. So, you know, I know what happens in unions. And I've, again, dealt with companies that were unionized. You know, I've seen situations where union members worked very, very hard, wanted to do the right thing, and in fact did the right things. And in situations, I've actually seen the union wanting to do correct things but were held back by management. So I agree. But again, I've seen situations, and this is, you know, a small percent, but it still occurred, where you had the radical union element that would do anything to disrupt the situation. And the union management actually, again, protected those workers. How often did you see a union member dismissed from their job? Now, in terms of pension, the pension is a contract between the company and the union. And now the pension or the retirees are saying, well, since the company can't honor that contract, now the American taxpayer has to. and you look at the situation, most taxpayers do not have retirement benefits. Most taxpayers do not have the health benefits of the UAW. So, you know, wouldn't there be resentment on the part of taxpayers who don't have these benefits but are being asked to pay for them?
I want to give the caller a real quick chance to follow up. I do have some other callers I want to get to. I don't know if you want to make a return comment.
Yeah, I do. I believe the man is not pro-union at all. He makes it sound like being a good worker is a rarity among union members, and it is not. It is a rarity to have troublemakers, but he seems to abide by the vision that is being put abroad and was started in the 50s that unions are bad, union members are lazy, union members don't deserve the contracts that they've been given. A contract is a contract. If the United States assumes responsibility for GM, then it assumes those pensions. If it doesn't, it goes to the courts, and the pension should come first. And if unions go down in this country, and they've been falling for a long time, they'll come back, but it'll be a long and bloody fight. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's try and get at least one other caller here. I want to go to Champagne in line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah?
Just a response to the there was a fellow called in. He was complaining about he had a Honda Civic that got better gas mileage than his PT Cruiser. Well, it's an apples and oranges comparison, because the Civic of the vintage he mentioned was designed to be far more fuel efficient, whereas the PT Cruiser was designed as a kind of a high performance minivan or something. I never have quite figured out what the virtue of it was, but it had a much more power. They came anyway with, many of them could be had anyway, with more powerful engines, and they had a completely different aerodynamic profile, which was really the part of the point of what I wanted to get at. This people bandy around the expression miles per gallon as if it's, you know, there's some sort of magic about it. Well, unfortunately, it's the simple laws of thermodynamics. If you have two vehicles with equivalent efficiency of producing horsepower, you know, they use the same amount of fuel to produce the same amount of power, and one is bigger and heavier and has a different aerodynamic profile than the other, and is driven faster than the other, then it's going to have considerably different fuel consumption characteristics. It's you know, one of the things that, just to digress slightly, that I think would help a great deal in our nation to help our vehicles be more efficient is to reinstate a national speed limit, a fairly low speed limit, because, you know, I really don't think people should be allowed to, or at least consider it their right to go as far as they want, as fast as they want in their car, where, you know, if you really have to go from point A to point B in a hurry and it's a considerable distance, you ought to be thinking about public transit or airplanes or something like that. But a fixed speed limit, say 55 miles an hour again, so the automotive engineers could design vehicles that would have an optimum fuel efficiency, say, at that value, and so forth. Thank you very much. And your comments, please.
All right. Well, Mr. Varag?
Okay. Two comments. In addition to aerodynamics, we also have what we call the laws of physics. Newer vehicles are mandated to have safety features that older vehicles did not have. That adds weight to the vehicle. If you compare a Civic from the 1970s to a Civic today, Civic today is probably 500 pounds heavier than the Civic of 1970, but its crashworthiness is significantly, in fact, exponentially better. You know, we have a trade-off between safety and fuel economy. And, you know, again, consumers are more interested today in safety than they were back in the 70s, because they're more aware of it. The second point, and I'm trying to recall what the caller mentioned was his second point.
Well, it was about maybe he thought it would be a better thing if we had a national speed limit.
National speed limit. That's correct. And, you know, I could refer to myself in that situation. My everyday vehicle is a Honda Civic, and the speed limits in this area are 65 and 70 miles an hour. I drive 60 miles an hour because that's the speed where I get the optimum fuel efficiency. But yet I see vehicles, you know, many times large SUVs and pickup trucks doing 80 miles an hour passing me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, a certain segment of the population is aware of the global energy crisis and want to do things about it. But the vast majority of people either do not know about it or don't care about it. And the people who do care about it are a very small percentage of the population. Yes, we probably should lower the speed limit. Again, that's a political decision. People don't want to drive their vehicles slower. You know, people don't want to be forced into smaller vehicles that are more fuel efficient. But yet, at some point in time, we as a nation are going to have to come to the realization that we cannot continue to do business as we have done it over the past century.
Yeah. Well, there we're going to have to leave it to our guest, Dennis Virag, is president at the Automotive Consulting Group in Ann Arbor, Michigan, for a long time. He's been following the auto industry. Mr. Virag, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.